Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soham. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soham. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soham. Thank you. So good afternoon. Hope you had a nice lunch. Is the sun shining with you? Yeah, it's come out here. It's literally just come out here. Beautiful. Good. So I'd like to start this afternoon looking again at equanimity. And if you remember Lama Tsongkhapa, on the ground of equanimity, plant the seed of compassion, water with loving kindness, and from that the harvest of bodhicitta will grow. In some of the books, the wording's slightly different, but that's how I learned it, and that seems very reasonable. And if equanimity is the basis for bodhicitta, we need to be sure that we're on the right page with equanimity. So this type of equanimity we're talking about is not the equanimity of feeling. It's not the equanimity says, yeah, I'm not for it, I'm not against it, I'm kind of, I'm equitable about it. It's not like that. Not like that. Feeling is the second aggregate. If you remember, form, feeling, the second aggregate. And what that's got to do with is a kind of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral indifference. That you could say there's some sort of equanimity there, but it's not the equanimity in relation to bodhicitta. That's not that equanimity. The equanimity we are talking about that is to do with bodhicitta comes from the fourth aggregate. And if you remember, first one is form, then feeling, then discrimination, and then compositional factors. Compositional factors. So here you're looking at most, but not all of the mental factors that actually compound whatever's going on in the mind. It's also the basis of karma here. It's not compounded, but it kind of comp it has a compositional effect on whatever behavior you have. So a lot of karma's in there, a lot of karma. But if you think of most of the mental states, really that's compositional factors. You're not talking about the mental factor of feeling. That's not in there. Neither the mental factor of lists. There's always lists. Discriminating awareness. So those two mental factors are not in compositional factors, but everyone else is. Every other mental factor is in there. So what you're looking at here, if we're saying that that's the equanimity we're looking here, in relation to that, what you're talking about equanimity here is a kind of mental state. A mental state when your meditation is not dull and your meditation is not agitated. That type of equitable mental state. Very close to shamatha, but not quite, but that equitable mental state. You need that equitable mental state in order to develop shamatha. To develop shamatha, we talked about that this morning, you really need a finely balanced mind. And so we're talking about equanimity here as a kind of balanced mind. The other type of equanimity that is also to do with bodhicitta is what's called immeasurable equanimity. And what you've got here with immeasurable equanimity is very active. It's the active recognition of the real suffering of all sentient beings and having the same feeling for them all. I'll say that again. Immeasurable equanimity is really looking at active recognition of the real suffering of sentient beings and feeling an equanimity for all, feeling the same for all. And one step further, it's still immeasurable, it's the structured wish for sentient beings to develop that equanimity for each other. So it's very strong. It's not just what you want, it's you're wishing it for them as well. Do you want me to repeat that just to make it clear? Okay, just to make it clear, because it's important. So the equanimity we're talking about on the basis of equanimity in the great scope is not the equanimity in relation to feeling, the second aggregate. It's not in relation to that. That's not connected with bodhicitta. Even though you may feel a bit of equanimity there, that's not that. It's got to do with the equanimity of compositional factors, which is the fourth aggregate. So this is a mental state that's equitable, steady, that's not too dull, falling asleep, not too agitated, but really quite steady. And you need that finely balanced mind in order to develop shamatha. So the equanimity is related to that. It's also related to immeasurable equanimity. And that's active. It's an active recognition of the real suffering. Not just, ouch, you know, not just I've got a pain. No, exactly what suffering is. And suffering is a big topic. So actively recognizing all these different types of suffering for sentient beings and having the same feeling for all of them. No preference. The same feeling to benefit them. And you take it a step further. There's also within that a strong wish for sentient beings to feel that for each other. There's no attachment here, no aversion, no indifference. Do not mix it with indifference. It's not that. It's so important that Buddhists tend to include it in their daily prayers. So if you take the prayer book and you turn to page 34 in the prayer book, and you'll see the heading is daily prayers. It's very rare that a Buddhist who does regular practice, meditation practice with a few prayers, does not include the four immeasurables. It's always in there. Now you can have the four immeasurables in a very short form as a prayer or quite a long form, but we'll look at this short form. Look what it's saying. This first verse, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And when you're on your own, you can pause here and really see to you, what does that mean to you? May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. You also learn to stop here and do a meditation. And the meditation you do will improve your loving kindness, because this first line is all about loving kindness, developing that. The second line says, may all sentient beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And that particular line is helping us develop compassion. That's what it's there for. And so many people stop at that line and do various meditations in order to enhance their compassion. Now, remember the definition of the first line, love. In Dharma, love means something very simple, wanting others to be happy. That's what it means. There's no stickiness there. There's no dependency. There's no wanting some sort of rebound. No. just the simple wish for wanting others to be happy. A definition of compassion within the Buddha Dharma is not wanting others to suffer. Very clear, very clear. Now, the third line says, may all sentient beings be separated from the happiness that is free from suffering. So where the first line is helping you develop immeasurable loving kindness, the second line is helping you develop immeasurable compassion. This line is helping you develop immeasurable joy. Immeasurable joy. May all sentient beings be separated, inseparable from the happiness that is free of suffering. And the last line, which is on page 35. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. That's helping us develop immeasurable equanimity. And as I say, after each line, sometimes people just do the lines and they move on, and that's fine. But you can do a whole retreat just on those four lines. And your retreat would be aimed at developing the four immeasurables. And you could develop a retreat around this, literally, after each verse, spending time contemplating the verse. No, I don't wish to. Good. Now, that prayer, I don't know, they keep wanting me to go to some airport. I've no idea why. What this is, that whole four lines, it's an immeasurable wish. Immeasurable comes in many forms. That prayer there in the four lines is a measurable wish, and you can develop a retreat around this. However, you can take it to its full extent of immeasurables by really looking at this in depth. And if we hand out now, Mary, the immeasurable four, the four immeasurable thoughts. Should look like that. I've no idea where this camera is. When we develop immeasurable thoughts towards all sentient beings, we create immeasurable bouts of merit. It's just the way it is. That's what happens. We purify immeasurable bouts of negative karma. Amazing. So let's look at this one, just the first part. And it says at the top here, immeasurable thought of equanimity. Sometimes this comes first, sometimes this comes last. But here's what I want to show you. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, free of hatred and attachment, not holding some close and others distance. That's equivalent to what we've been talking about in the other prayer group. That's an immeasurable wish. Now, if you want to extend that, you continue. May they abide in equanimity. Now that becomes an immeasurable prayer. I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity. That becomes an immeasurable intent. And the last line, please, Guru Deity, bless me to be able to do this. This becomes an immeasurable request. And you could use this daily, or you could use this within retreat, and you would do exactly the same way. After each verse, you would pause. And there's different types of meditations you can do, but each verse is really about enhancing a particular quality. And this first verse is about immeasurable equanimity. The second, immeasurable loving kindness. The third, immeasurable compassion. And the fourth, immeasurable joyfulness. If you're going to do that as a practice, once you've finished the verse and you've done the meditation that you want to do, really best to stop thinking too much and literally allowing a feeling of whatever the verse is going, say compassion, allow the feeling of immeasurable compassion to arise, having done the verse, having done the meditation, and then for a few minutes or longer, stay with that feeling of immeasurable, whether it's compassion, loving kindness, equanimity. This will really begin to change the mind. And in that way, you'll be not just analytical meditation coming in here, but some sort of single pointed concentration. And that ability just to stop the mental chatter at the end and allow that joyful feeling or that feeling of love or compassion to arise. And when it's as strong as you think you can do, let everything else go, focus. And then move on to the next verse. So that's one way. And I know people who do long retreats literally just on this. It's so valuable. So valuable. I think it's self-explanatory, but is there any questions about that? Any thoughts? Now, if that's equanimity, then what is the best type of meditation to do to develop equanimity? Well, there are many. There are many. On the teachings I've had from many teachers, including Geshe Tashi, he says there's so many different types of meditation to develop equanimity. But the most effective ones tend to be based on impermanence and based on relationships. Impermanence and relationships seems to be the most effective to develop equanimity. So if you want to finish writing, take a stretch and then get yourself into a good posture for meditation, that would be great. Humming is getting louder, but never mind. So, bringing the mind inward. Paying attention to how the body's responding to the breath. Yep, that keeps the mind inward. Identifying any achy areas, any tense areas. Begin to release that tension on the out-breath. And as you do that, one part of your mind can be checking the rest of your body, making sure the tension is going, the smoothness of your forehead, the relaxation of your facial muscles, the eyes feeling spacious around the eyes, between the eyes, the shoulders dropping. Tummy unclenched. Changing your awareness to the rise and fall of the abdomen with the breath. This is very good for increasing your stability. Stay with the rising and falling of the abdomen with the breath. Maintaining whatever level of relaxation you've reached. Change your focus to the in-breath. And just notice that on each natural in-breath, your mind is becoming brighter, clearer, and sharper. And so, like many meditations in the Dharma, you set up a visualization. These visualizations can be as elaborate as you like or as simple as you like. But imagine that in front of you are three people sitting cross-legged, facing you. Maybe about a meter and a half away from you, 2 meters maximum. And they're looking at you. The middle person is a total stranger to you, or someone that you've met in passing, but you don't really know them. You kind of know their face, but they're kind of a stranger. That's the middle person. To the left, that's your left. That person is someone to whom you have a strong attachment. To your right, someone you have a strong aversion to, someone who disturbs your mind. They're just sitting there placidly looking at you. Now take each in turn and with honesty and courage, examine why this person you have a strong attachment to. With courage, why this person you have a strong aversion to. And with deep interest, why that middle person is a stranger to you. Just examine. The one to whom you have a strong attachment to or aversion can be fairly straightforward. But this middle one, the stranger, why is it you have a kind of feeling towards the stranger? Why? Examine that more closely. A simple, because I don't know them, that's not enough. Examine again. Now question yourself. And the first question you ask yourself is, how true are these categories that I put these three people in? Friend, enemy, stranger. How true are these categories? Questions you never ask, but ask this one. Next, ask another question of yourself. How permanent are these categories? How impermanent are these categories? We've labeled them friend, enemy, stranger. Is this permanent category or is it impermanent? Just look deeply. And the last question to ask yourself is it possible that these categories are false? Is it possible that these categories are false? Our attitude towards others is normally unbalanced, with liking, disliking, and indifference flowing around, coming and going. Normally, our attitude unbalanced. This unbalanced mind is the main obstacle to the Mahayana path. The main obstacle. It keeps us circling in samsara. It increases discrimination and self-grasping. And the concept of self, I, me, mine becomes even more concrete because of this unbalanced mind. And of course, it has a result, and the result is a strong attachment to me and my happiness. And when that's up in our minds, then greed follows. Strong greed. And all negative minds arise from this. Not so much the greed, but the attachment to me and my happiness. So anger and aversion also arise from this unbalanced mind. It arises from greed, self-attachment, and this strong I, and I will discriminate heavily against whoever disturbs my happiness. I will. And thus, I produce and I label enemy. We think enemies come from the outside. it has an effect. But here it's saying, because of this unbalanced mind and attachment to I, me, and mine, and discriminating because of it, because it disturbs my happiness, I produce and I label others enemy. Can you see how that flows? When greed arises in the mind from this unbalanced mind, it is the greed that identifies friends that help me and enemies that hinder me. And what does that result in? Well, it results in anger that leads us to hating and harming others, especially those we label enemy. Greed arises, which leads to attachment and helping the friend, but no one else. And even your friends had better watch out. And ignorance leads us to really see strangers as a kind of permanent entity, a kind of permanent nothing to do with me. They don't help me, they don't hinder me, nothing to do with me. It is by following these negative mind states that I create suffering for myself and others. And really, it's these mind states in the world that creates danger for the whole earth and beyond. It's where it starts. Attachment offers no peace, just more of the same. And if I continue the way I've been going with this unbalanced mind, enlightenment is impossible to achieve. Impossible. However clever you are, that will not happen. So try to build up a strong determination in your mind. I shall free my mind of unbalanced attitudes. I will reduce attachment, aversion, and indifference towards any living being. That will not be in my mind. Neither attachment, aversion, or indifference. When I encounter any living being, that will not be in my mind. I shall strive to be equitable. Try to make that really strong in your mind. And when it's as strong as you can make it, let everything else go. And gently focus on that determination. Thank you. If you want to take this opportunity just to jot down any thoughts or ideas that you have, it's amazing how quickly it flies from the mind. So, if on the ground of equanimity we're planting the seed of compassion, we need to know what this compassion is. So we all have ordinary compassion, and that's good to have. If you have ordinary compassion, then you're on a bandwidth to go straight to bodhicitta. If you've no compassion, then there's a big problem. But if you have any form of compassion, you're on that bandwidth. But ordinary compassion is not great compassion, and it's not bodhicitta. So when you have compassion these days for someone or something, perhaps what's happening, you know, abroad with a war, perhaps with people who are suffering still because of this government's attitude to COVID and various other things. The last time you felt compassion, please, what came with it in your mind stream? You felt compassion, you labeled it compassion. Was there any other feelings going on there? Was it just pure compassion and nothing else? Or was it, I feel compassion, but something else was going on in the mind as well? What type of things do you think could have been going on in the mind? Ordinary compassion rarely is on its own in the mind stream. Got a lot of humming again, a lot of humming. Anyone want to make a thought? What could be going on in the mind as well? Type of feelings accompany it? Yeah. Oh, would you say that some sadness is often there? Would you say that? Yeah? So with ordinary compassion, there is often sadness with it. Sometimes a lot of sadness. Sometimes a lot of sadness that leads to tears. That happens. Is there any other feeling that would accompany this ordinary compassion? It's after lunchtime, everybody's sleepy. Maybe?
Feeling like you want to help somebody to get out of the stuck.
Yeah. A feeling of wanting to do something, for sure.
Also anger.
Anger, definitely. How could this possibly be happening? Are these people mad? I'm just telling you what happens to be. Are these people completely crazy? What are they doing? How could anybody behave like that? And what tends to follow from that? from pity for those poor people. Those poor people. I wish I could do something, but I can't. I'm stuck here. How come then people are not doing more? How come the government can't at least process applications quicker so that I can give a room in my house to some refugees instead of me spending two hours or 2 days on a computer trying to do application forms that go right above my head? How would you translate that? Frustration. Lots of frustration. So with ordinary compassion, all of that's there. Also, with ordinary compassion, you're looking for a good result. And you're investing emotion in some sort of good result to come. And there's also quite a strong sense of self-interest. Always, always a strong sense. And if you're ever in a position where you're feeling compassion towards someone and you then have all these feelings going and you actually do something and it's been helpful to that individual, what do you expect? You're expecting some sort of payback. You are. It's human. This I, me, and mine. You've no choice. You'll think of that. Even if you're not expecting financial, even if you're not expecting great things, how many times do we say, after all I did for that person, and they didn't even say thank you? At least we want to thank you. With this, you have partiality. Partiality comes in. And with that partiality, now you have some discrimination. Well, that's the last time I do that. Or yes, I'll continue to help this person, but I'm not going to get as involved as I was before. This other person is far more worthy. They said, thank you. So ordinary compassion, is it good? Yes, of course it is. We should continue with our ordinary compassion, but it's tainted. It's tainted by not having an understanding of the nature of reality and attachment and aversion. It will always be tainted. And it will always expect payback, always. But it's possible by practicing bodhicitta, doing the particular meditations I've talked about, for you to develop what's called great compassion. This is the type of compassion that wants to free people from their suffering. It's a type of compassion that really wants to protect this individual. Really wants to protect. It goes beyond, oh, I'm feeling sorry. This is great compassion. It's about wanting to protect this other person. Wanting to free them from suffering, yes, but really also protection. Apart from sadness, and it's a human trait, and it's a trait found in bodhisattvas, sadness. Yes, sadness can be there. Not overwhelming sadness that leads to other things, although it can, but some form of sadness still within great compassion, that's possible. But all the rest does not exist with great compassion. There is no frustration. There is no feeling sorry. There is no pity. There's no hanging on to a good result. There is no sense of self-interest here. No chance of payback, no partiality, no discrimination. Great compassion is none of that. So what does it have in its stead? Yes, there's a possibility of sadness, I think, is always there. That's how I've been taught. And I can see that. It's very human. But what arises with that great compassion is none of those negativities. What arises is a sense of joy, a sense of willingness to help. This type of great compassion is unconditional. The ego is not front and center at all. And you never ever cling to a result. ever. And we all have a degree of compassion that can be developed into great compassion with wisdom. It is impossible. It is possible for ordinary compassion to bring you suffering. Of course it is, because it has all these negative mental traits with it, and people will suffer. You see people who are compassionate and they burst into tears and they literally can't do anything for the emotion. And everybody around them goes, there, you know, don't worry. And there are very emotional people. And you can see that it's coming, you know, they think it's coming from a good place, but this is just, all this does is make you immobile. These emotions just make you immobile. Because we're exaggerating it now. We're exaggerating all that. So people are not doing it on purpose. It's just the habit we have of inappropriate attention. Do you remember the fifth all-accompanying mental factor? Inappropriate attention and then exaggerating whatever emotion is going on. Great compassion will never do that. It can never bring you suffering, ever. Can't do it. It's not possible. It won't bring you frustration and it won't bring you pain. Some sadness, yes, but when you've developed great compassion, these other things don't come with it. They don't. You can develop this just by increasing your familiarity. You increase your familiarity, the meditations, the study around this, just the practice. And you will find that these all these other negative accompanying emotions, mental problems, they won't come with it. A sense of sadness often, but apart from that, nothing else. That's when you know. People say, well, how do I know I've got great compassion? That's how you know. Increasing familiarity with great compassion and all those negativities disappear. So this compassion in relation to the path, the Buddhist path, is much more than the compassion that we sometimes feel now. It's immeasurable. Why? Because it's limitless. The object of your compassion is limitless. The scope of your compassion is vast, limitless scope of your compassion. Recognizing all this for all sentient beings, it's wonderful. I mean, it's just so freeing. And yet, there is still no responsibility here. And yet, still, you're not taking any responsibility for other beings. So this is great compassion, but it's not bodhicitta. But what great compassion does do, it gives you the strength and the courage to start to take responsibility upon yourself for the welfare of all sentient beings. You start to accept this is not someone else's problem, this is mine. On the Mahayana path, I take responsibility. And when you take responsibility and you take the vows in relation to that, then you're developing bodhicitta. But there's no bodhicitta without great compassion. And I can't see how you could possibly develop great compassion without having ordinary compassion. And remember that bodhicitta really is a main mind. And this main mind has two thoughts. Normally, you can't hold two thoughts in the same mind together. One comes after the other so fast you think you do, but you don't. But bodhicitta, you've got the thought of wanting to become enlightened and the thought for the sake of all sentient beings. And when these two thoughts come together in the same mind, that's a bodhicitta mind. That's the mind of bodhicitta. So there's many ways of looking at bodhicitta, categorizing it. If you look at levels of bodhicitta, then what you find, and you'll find it in the books, any of the commentaries, there's something called aspirational bodhicitta. Aspirational bodhicitta. And of course, that's the mind that has the strong wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings, without exception. And that's really like a blessing. It's like planting the seed. And quite a few teachers will give you a blessing for this. If it's in your mind and you want a blessing, this aspirational bodhicitta can be very helpful. What does the aspirational bodhicitta lead to? What does it give birth to? It gives birth to engaging bodhicitta. Engaging bodhicitta. And that's when you actually make the commitment, you take the vows, and you get out to the field and you start to walk the Mahayana path, the path of the Bodhisattva, by developing the six perfections. And you can have a look at that, the six perfections. Another way of looking at bodhicitta, you'll find bodhicitta described as conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. You don't have to remember all this. It's just if you meet it again, it'll be a recognition to you. It's always good to do, you know, different studies on all these topics. But conventional bodhicitta is a primary mind motivated by great compassion that spontaneously seeks to enlightenment for the benefit of all. All your merit comes together. So conventional bodhicitta actually is bodhicitta. That's what it is. But there is something called ultimate bodhicitta. And that isn't bodhicitta at all. What it is, it's wisdom. Ultimate bodhicitta is the wisdom motivated by conventional bodhicitta. It's the wisdom generated, motivated by conventional bodhicitta. It's called ultimate bodhicitta, but it really is wisdom. But it's wisdom. The intention behind it is conventional bodhicitta, and that becomes ultimate bodhicitta. And there's, you know, quite a few discussions, and it gets, you know, I love doing weekends and bits on bodhicitta, because then you can go into this quite deeply. So can you understand there are many different ways to classify bodhicitta? If you classify it by levels, then you can say there's aspirational bodhicitta and there's engaging bodhicitta. These are the ones you're really interested in. I mean, this is the doing of it. This is the doing of it. But you can't say there's conventional bodhicitta, which is bodhicitta, and there's ultimate bodhicitta, which is wisdom motivated by conventional bodhicitta. Any thoughts, ideas, comments? So quiet after lunch. Always so quiet after lunch, gosh. But that's life. Okay. So we obviously can't do all the meditations in bodhicitta. But I think it'd be quite good to do recognizing the shortcomings of self-cherishing and recognizing the benefits of cherishing others. So if you want to take a minute or two just to stretch, move, and get yourself into a good space, and then settle down. Okay. So again, getting in a good position, drawing the mind inward, relaxing, sharpening the mind. Consider that the great Shantideva said, the only difference between Buddhas and those who are unenlightened, that's us, is the self-cherishing mind. It's the only difference. So we must correctly understand the object. The self-centered attitude is the wrong way of cherishing oneself. And here's where people make a difference. Please consider this. Cherishing yourself is wonderful. If you can cherish yourself, you have a good chance of cherishing others. If you can love yourself, you have a good chance of loving others. If you can be compassionate towards yourself, you will be compassionate towards others. Consider that. Is that a true statement or not? The self-cherishing mind that the Dharma talks about is someone with a self-centered attitude. And that is seen as the wrong way of cherishing yourself. Dharma, Buddha Dharma never says that self-cherishing is wrong. What is wrong is the self-cherishing attitude, because it's the wrong way to cherish yourself. If you want to cherish yourself, practice bodhicitta. That's the best way to cherish yourself. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama puts it a different way. He says, if you want to be self-centered a bit, then be wisely self-centered. Practice bodhicitta. If you want to cherish yourself in a wise way. Practice bodhicitta. But the self-cherishing attitude, with a poor understanding of emptiness, with a strong sense of self and I, that is always completely mistaken and is completely the wrong way to cherish yourself. So considering the disadvantages of the self-cherishing attitude as opposed to wisely looking after yourself. Just consider that we usually regard ourselves as especially precious and important. How we live our life, we're front and center always. And why not, we think? I'm here to look after myself, of course. I'll look after others, but really I have to take care of myself. We usually regard ourselves as especially precious and especially important. It is our happiness that matters most. And we can hold that attitude while being kind to other people. For yes, you can hold both. That seeing yourself as especially important and that your happiness matters most is the biggest obstacle to any and all Dharma practices. Any and all. Motivated by a self-cherishing attitude, the wrong way of cherishing yourself, then that's the basis for many negative acts of body, speech, and mind. And that's the basis for our experience suffering, misfortune. And so you could say, the truth of it is that all suffering comes from this self-cherishing attitude. What happens when we overhear the slightest criticism about ourselves? What happens when we hear a lie that's put about ourselves? What happens? Immediately, we feel pain. Immediately. Because the self-cherishing mind only wants to hear positive things and praise. Self-cherishing attitude kicks in as if it were defending you. And it's doing the opposite. The self-cherishing mind only wants to hear positivity and praise. And we like it because we think this attitude is helping us, it's defending us, it's protecting us. The opposite is true. Much of our unhappiness, our depression, I'm not talking about clinical depression here, but much of our happiness and depression, any mental discomfort can be seen as the result of that self-cherishing attitude that regards only yourself as important. And that means there's no real wish in that mind to benefit others at that moment. There's no wish. But we do assume, we generally assume that this type of self-cherishing is necessary. It's necessary for my survival. I need it to look after myself. If I don't do it, who will? Are you asking me not to defend myself? You don't need any other defense. You have self-cherishing. That'll do it for you. And on the surface, that seems to be true. Just investigate. On the surface, does that not seem to be true? Think deeply again, but this time with karma. Understanding karma and suffering, bring that into the equation when you think deeply about this. If you do, you realize that instead of needing self-cherishing for survival, the opposite is true. Self-cherishing attitude constantly and continuously destroys our well-being. it can destroy our very survival. Anger and despair only arises from attachment to our own happiness. This self-cherishing is a source of all misfortune. Instead of helping us, a self-cherishing attitude disguises itself, and we've been habituated to think. This self-cherishing attitude doesn't even bring short-term happiness. Try to see self-cherishing attitude through wisdom eyes. Shantideva makes this very clear when he says, all the suffering there is in the world arises from wishing ourselves to be happy. All the suffering there is in the world arises from wishing ourselves to be happy. All the happiness there is in the world arises from wishing others to be happy. All the happiness there is in the world arises from wishing others to be happy. Consider that. Thank you. If you want to make a few notes about the disadvantages of self-cherishing attitude, making sure that you're really clear about the difference between the self-cherishing attitude and how to truly cherish yourself. It's vital you cherish yourself, but you cherish yourself wisely through bodhicitta. Does anyone want to feedback, ask a question, make a comment? Yes, Gabriel? Sorry, I'm having a bit of difficulty with the interference. Speak up a bit.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Thinking about self-cherishing and kind of wanting other people to be happy. If there's someone who, I mean, talking about myself, sometimes I really want to be liked, so I kind of neglect my own needs in favour of others. And it comes from a place of ego, it's not a good thing. And I end up in a place where I'm no use to anyone around me because I've kind of drained myself. What I struggle with is trying to identify the difference between I'm actually being selfless, I'm actually saying I can take this hit, you know, that's fine, and it's they're more important, and, you know, I don't know, because of something in my childhood or whatever, I'm just neglecting myself and not standing up for myself. Is there a way to kind of know the difference and know in which situations?
Well, it's really repeating what I said. I'm sorry if I repeat it, but it takes a while to hear this, really. It's know the difference between self-cherishing attitude and truly cherishing yourself. Know that difference. That's important. There is a difference between ordinary compassion. Ordinary compassion taking out into extremes or more than you can handle will always leave you feeling empty, wasted, regretful, you know, really just because of all the frustration, the self-pity that comes in, the sadness, the not getting the response you wanted, and yet you did this. This is ordinary compassion, right? It's not wise. I mean, it helps, ordinary compassion, as long as you don't go too much into it. It does help, and it can lead to great compassion. But the change comes when you understand that physically and verbally, you can do exactly the same thing with great compassion. Exactly, there's no difference. Physically and verbally, you could be doing exactly the same thing as you did with ordinary compassion. The only difference is the mind. The mind that understands the difference. That doesn't let pity, frustration, self-cherishing come into it, because it's a wrong view of self, it's a wrong view of others, and it just leads you away. So what you actually do may never change. What you actually say to people to help them may never change, but the mind changes. The attitude is always great compassion, not expecting result, not feeling frustration, not getting exhausted, not feeling pity. Sadness, of course, not expecting a result. It all comes from the mind. You may never change what you do physically or verbally. So it always comes back to the mind. Understand ignorance, attachment, and aversion. That's where all your exhaustion comes from. Ignorance, attachment, and aversion is where all your negative states come from. Ignorance, attachment, aversion is where all your frustration, your pity, the poor me, they didn't bother even to say thank you. I'm exhausted. The more I do, the more they want, you know, and on, inappropriate attention comes in here. Where is it all coming from? The mind of misknowing reality. Really. And so understanding that difference is very helpful, but you need to make great effort, because we think, just tell me what to do, right? And I will do it differently and I won't feel so bad. No. Well, tell me how to handle it verbally and I'll feel better, won't I? Well, that's what ordinary stuff does. But Dharma's not asking you to do ordinary compassion. You have already. Great compassion doesn't ask any of that. It asks you to use wisdom here. And you'll know you're doing it right when less frustration. Less pity. When someone doesn't say thank you, yeah. You sort of go, well, it would have been nice. But there you go. It doesn't stop you doing it again for that person. You have sadness, of course. If someone is suffering, it's very sad. But you don't exaggerate that sadness. You don't have inappropriate attention. You don't allow it to transform into heavy, heavy emotion, because all this emotion, well, who is it about? It's about me. I, me, and mine. Yeah. Cool, huh? It's cool. It's cool. This is why, if you learn, if you really take just a little bit of notes of what I'm telling you, I'm giving you really pith lam rim here. And hopefully, if you think it's reasonable, then you start looking at that structure and start developing that structure. To learn it from what I'm giving you might be, unless you're very ripe, it would be difficult. But if you then say this is reasonable and you go on to develop, especially the different topics within the lam rim, the different scopes, then it will become more and more natural to you to behave that way. Yeah. Yeah. I wish. Yeah. I love that one. And they didn't even say thank you. I don't know how many times I've heard that. Did they not? Oh, dear. Well, I'm never doing that again, because it never stops there. When someone says, they never even said thank you, just wait, because other things are going to come. And the other things are usually, well, I'm never doing, you know, I'm never helping her again. It'd be a long time before I ever do this. Maybe I'll go here and help these people. These, you know, it never comes on its own. Waiting for some sort of response, never on its own. It's never good enough. If someone says to you, I really like that, right? There's the response, right? I bet you in your mind, or you say, really, which part did you like best? Which part of that really helped you? Give me more. Give me more sugar. Give me more. That's what we do. And all that does really is to make the self even stronger. And it reinforces ordinary compassion. Ordinary compassion is useful. Just don't let it go too far, because all it does is take you back into samsara with negative mind states. Transform it into great compassion. Do it. And then what's really interesting, they tell me about great compassion, is that when you decide at a moment's notice and you say to yourself, no, I'm not going to do this for this person or this situation. I'm not going to do it for myself. I think it's better that I just take a bit of time for myself and rethink and relook at the Dharma, maybe do a bit of meditation, maybe go for a walk. There's nothing wrong with doing that. As long as your motivation's wrong, there's nothing wrong with stepping away in order to, you know, just maybe reset the mind a bit. Because maybe it's going over too much into ordinary compassion and you're getting some rebound, right? So there's nothing wrong with saying, I wish I could help, but at the moment, I'm just not in that zone. But I'll get back to that. I'm just going to take some time for myself at the moment just to rebuild. There's nothing wrong with that. You're not a cash cow for emotions. You're not a cash cow for benefiting. You will become that. Bodhisattvas never take a holiday. You never hear of a bodhisattva saying, right, I've had enough, I need 2 weeks break. Everybody just take care of themselves. Bodhisattvas don't do that. Awake and asleep. Bodhisattvas are working for the benefit of others. That's their mindset. Our mindset, I don't know about you, but my mindset's the opposite. I can't wait to take a break. I'm going to visit a friend in May, and I've not spent a night outside my house for 2.5 years. Well, I'm sorry. Self-cherishing, very strong, very strong. Okay. Anyone else? Yes, Anna.
Yeah. Okay, I was just on mute still. So you explained that really, really well for me to get it with the ordinary compassion and great compassion. Can you... Because I think it's often the terminology that gets me as well. So it's the self-cherishing attitude versus the sort of truly self-cherishing.
How to cherish yourself wisely. I think that's a good way to think about it, because it implicates wisdom.
And does that, if I sort of try to transpose what you said about the compassion, does that mean that the self-cherishing attitude has all these kind of negative sort of things attached,
yes,
like self-pity,
yes,
or whatever else? I'm just trying to sort of, you know, fill it with a bit of example or meaning in my mind. So because the words are so similar, and it's where because I think there is this sort of, you know, you got to be, like you just said, you've got to be in a decent place to help others, and sometimes it's better maybe to take a break. But I'm just trying to get these two right without sort of thinking.
Well, start with language. Always start with language. So the language code you just start using now. It's whenever somebody says self-cherishing in Dharma, they mean self-cherishing attitude. It's negative. Okay? When His Holiness says, if you're going to be selfish, be wisely selfish, practice bodhicitta, he says, right? So the language code that goes with that, I would say wisely self-cherishing. No, wisely cherishing yourself. Then you won't confuse yourself and others, because other Buddhists will hear, oh, she's saying that self-cherishing attitude is wisdom. And then they get very hung up on language. So whenever anybody says self-cherishing is wrong, what they mean is the self-cherishing attitude is wrong. And His Holiness is saying, be wise, practice bodhicitta. If you're going to self-cherish, be wise, practice bodhicitta. So the language code would be something like wisely self-cherishing, or cherishing yourself with wisdom. If you say that to someone in Dharma, they will not mistake it. So thinking about this, think about the evolution of self-cherishing, the self-cherishing attitude. First of all, it's misknowing reality, right? I see everything as having a self. You have a self and you cherish yourself. I have a self and cherish myself. This mouse has a self. Everything's got something within it that's concrete, unchanging and permanent. Okay? Now from that, you develop a very strong I, me, mine. And from I, me, mine, you've no choice. Self-cherishing comes from this attitude. Self-cherishing, now, I want this because I like it, and I don't want that because I don't like it. The self-cherishing attitude comes from a wrong conception of who you are. So from ignorance of nature of reality comes I, me, and mine. From I, me, and mine comes self-cherishing. Self-cherishing attitude. I find that very useful. And you're right, a lot of these words sound very similar, and people play about with words. And when English is not the first language, then it can be even more difficult. And you could say that to someone whose first language isn't English, and they would go, yes, self-cherishing is wrong. You've got somebody else like me saying, well, actually, no, it's a self-cherishing attitude. It's not that they don't have the knowledge. It's sometimes it's to do with just establishing a reasonable language code. Okay, so what we're going to do now is do the opposite. Have a look at the advantages of cherishing others. So try to get yourself in a nice place. This is the last meditation, I promise, don't worry. Quite short. Get yourself into a good space. Bringing the mind inward. Never not do this, you know. Never just sit down and try and meditate. Sit down and get your body right. Bring the mind in. Relax. Sharpen the mind. Become still and stable. Then go on with the meditation. So we consider a statement. All sentient beings deserve to be cherished. All sentient beings deserve to be cherished with tremendous kindness. Apart from many things, all our own, all my temporary and ultimate happiness depends on the kindness of sentient beings. Whether at the moment they're your friend, whether at the moment they're your enemy, whether at the moment they're strangers. From birth, growing, jobs, food, travel, etc. The mere fact that we're alive, the mere fact that we have skills and abilities, solely through the kindness of sentient beings, solely through the kindness of sentient beings. It's not that you're just being beneficent to others. You're repaying their kindness. All those unknown people that are responsible for your temporary and ultimate happiness. All those unknown sentient beings, countless, that working together created jobs, helped you grow, didn't let you die. Jobs are available. Food is easily got. Travel, usually, not a problem. You would never be able to stop writing down the types of people that have helped you and continue to help you. Helping others is not you being beneficent. It is repaying that kindness. Try to think like that. This is a truth that we never recognize, or if we do, only fleetingly. And often we have a response within ourselves that comes like, well, they may have helped me, but they had no intention of helping me. This was just by the by. They were paid for it. This is how we respond. Even if these people had no intention of benefiting you, that is irrelevant. You still benefited. It is irrelevant that they never thought of benefiting you. You still benefited. And so the need to repay is quite strong. Never mind, no judgment here about how much they were paid and the fact they were paid, or you provided jobs because you need. It's all nonsense. Leave it. No judgment whether they intended. It's irrelevant. You still benefited. And unless you've got clairvoyance, you have no idea what other people's motivation is. We barely have an idea what our motivation is. How do you know they had no intentions of benefiting you? We don't know. It's better to focus on what you do know. And that's the practical benefits that you continuously receive from countless, immeasurable sentient beings. Imagine everything that you owned is in this room. Imagine this room is full of everything that you own. Cars, caravans, your house, all the contents of your house. Anything you own, imagine it's in this room. Now imagine that you had to give back everything that you received from others. Now I don't care if you paid for it. You got it from others. Imagine you now start to empty this room. Give it back. Everything that others have given us, give it back. Just mentally do it. Give back the clothes on your body. Your glasses. False teeth. Just me then, is it? Hearing aids. you now naked because others gave this to you. Now start to give back your body, the parts of your body. Give them back to your mother and your father because they're not yours. They were given to you by your parents. They're not yours. Give it back. What are you left with that's truly yours, that hasn't been given to you by others? Only the mind. If you gave back absolutely everything that others gave you, you would have nothing at all, including your body. We need others to develop physically, emotionally, spiritually. It's a fallacy to think that you can secure your own welfare without the help of others, without neglecting others. If you neglect others, it's completely unrealistic if you think you can secure your own welfare. Allow your mind to ride these thoughts. Try to bring into the mind a strong determination. I must cherish all sentient beings. I must repay their kindness. I must cherish all sentient beings. I must repay their kindness. And when that thought is strong, let everything else go. Focus. Here's how it works. You're sitting here, you're forgetting, your mind's wandering. Try to remember two or three of the strongest points in this meditation. Build up that strong determination again. Then let go of the verbal chatter and focus. So the mind will wander. You bring it back, but it's not strong. So remember some of the main points. Build up the determination again. Then focus. Make a strong effort for the last 2 minutes. Thank you. So you might want to jot down a few thoughts, I don't know. Always useful to do it immediately. Okay, thank you. So I just want to check that you're all clear about this evening, looking at the commitments of taking refuge. My advice would be to split into three groups, but up to you. Each one of you taking either what's to be avoided, what's to be practiced, or general advice, and then coming together to discuss. You'll notice on that sheet at the bottom, there is some commitments for aspiring bodhicitta. Remember, when you're dividing bodhicitta, one of the ways you can divide it is in levels of bodhicitta. So this aspiring bodhicitta is that strong wish to benefit all sentient beings without exception. It's not committing you to anything, but so if you've got time and you want to do it, you can look at the commitments again. Don't be too heavy on this word commitments. And that comes when you actually really take strong vows, right? But this is more like advices, really. So if you've got time, you can look at that. And tomorrow morning, I see you at 10 o'clock. And then I whiz down to Land of Joy. And those of you who want to have a chat, we have a chat. I'm hoping to start at 2 o'clock, if not before, but 2-ish. In the room opposite the Gompa, there'll be, thanks to Mary, there'll be a video there of Lama Yeshe, Lama Yeshe's teaching. And I'm hoping whoever's put their name down for the list will be there. So then if the weather is good, we kind of go for a walk for 20 minutes. So. Okay. Thank you very much for this afternoon. Deeply appreciate it. Deeply appreciate it. And so now we do some dedication prayers. So we're looking at page 235. In the book, in the prayer book. Remembering the motivation you had right at the very beginning of the day. All this merit you're creating, now let's keep it safe, let's dedicate it. Due to these merits, of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. And tomorrow morning we start on emptiness. Yes.